testimony. I'd like to start by saying that I think it's important for the committee to understand that most of the acknowledged counties have no minimum lot size in their EFU zone. So when you look at this section of the bill and it says if you have a minimum lot size you can give somebody a dwelling, you're talking about less than a majority of the counties that have already come through the process. That means that a number of counties are going to have to use a different procedure because they cannot grant those dwellings outright. I'd like to explain to you what the impact on that process is in Marion County, and then you can extrapolate from that as to how it might apply to your county. We would then, because we have no minimum lot size, have to drop down to the section that you've been discussing and take a look at whether or not the parcel is 20 or more acres in size, and then get this information from the census out that's been requested or been stipulated here in the Act. And I'd like to just give you some statistics for Marion County. Recalling that in the next test, anything that's planted in perennials that will generate $10,000 in income is entitled to a dwelling. I took the 11 groups that are listed in the census, and there were three of them that appeared to me the kinds of perennials that the bill was addressing, and so I took those out of my calculations so that we wouldn't get the information skewed. Dealing with the other eight categories, in Marion County there were 1,292 farms that had an average of over $2,500 in income.
How many?
1,292. Of those, 862, or 66.7%, are under the average for that particular group. Let me give you a couple of examples. Cash grains, for example, we had 149 acres was the average farm size for a farm that was predominantly cash grains. 75 out of 122 in Marion County were below that average. So if those properties today were to come in and ask for a dwelling, I would have to say you're over 20 acres, but you don't meet the average test of 149 acres.
Madam Chair.
So we cannot approve a dwelling on that property, and we would then have to drop down to the third test. The second test would be of no value to us. I have no group here that allows less than 20 acres for an average farm size. So in almost all of these cases, these properties that come in are going to be below the average and will not be able to qualify under the second test.
Russ?
Yes.
You already know on all of those that of that second group that is under the average for that particular farm or is less than 20 acres, either one of those, you already know that in the past 2 years they haven't produced $10,000 in gross income?
I'm just using a stepladder approach and starting out by saying we don't have a minimum lot size, then we go to the next test.
Right.
Who do we kick out on that test? Okay. And those that we can't kick out on that test, we go to the third test.
Right.
And all I'm saying is that for a no minimum lot size county, the second test is of relatively little benefit, it appears, because I think this is going to be typical of most of the counties. Mm-hmm. And we are then in a position, in a no minimum lot size county, of having to use that $10,000 income criteria.
Right.
Which means, let me explain. If a farmer came into Marion County today and said, I've got 120 acres and I want to divide it into 260-acre parcels, mm-hmm. we would have to look at those 260-acre parcels and say, are they both similar to and capable of sustaining commercial agriculture, and are they similar to the other size of parcels that are commercial agriculture in the area? So we use that standard.
Okay.
No, it's just commercial agriculture based on what's going on within a half a mile. We could go ahead and approve the parcel, but then because that was a 60-acre parcel and cash grains require an average of 149, I couldn't allow the guy to have a dwelling on it unless, as Hector was explaining, he could show that that 60-acre portion of his farm in the last two consecutive years generated $10,000 worth of income. If he can pull that out of his financial records, And if he's the buyer, that means he's got to go back to the seller and ask the seller to give us that information. Then we could take a look at it and give him a dwelling that showed that. If for some reason it did not generate the $10,000, I would then have to say, based on our criteria, it's a commercial agricultural enterprise, but you're going to have to go out there and farm it for 2 years before we can allow you to have a dwelling.
Yes, and Russ, second question I have, what would it take for you to change it to minimum lot sizes in your county?
We have over 100 different kinds of crops in Marion County, and we struggle with the idea.
If you wanted a minimum lot size in your county.
I would have to go back through the plan and ordinance amendment process and resubmit it to LCDC for acknowledgement.
And how many of those places that you looked at in 1,200 farms, how many of those already had log houses on them?
I'm sure most of them do, but I think it's important as an indication of the kinds of situations that are going to present it to us in the future.
Meeting's recess. Please pick up your stuff.
Excuse us.
Meeting of Environment Energy will once again come back to order. We are on page six.
Page seven.
Top of the page.
I don't think
it's that bad. It's not that bad. Better than being getting hot. You can get hot and sweaty in here.
They'll stop mowing the lawn.
Madam
Chair? Oh.
There's a phone right in the back. Elizabeth said she would straighten out the to make sure that we've separated farm and woodlot there, clarifying that section. Hector, did you have some language or anything that you wanted for that loophole you saw?
I can get you some. I'm not the lawyer, okay. But I will have it if you agree.
Sir.
In terms of concept, I'll certainly get the language.
Okay. Any
questions?
Mm-hmm. Did you, Hector's concept, and I suppose we could get language, you just called Elizabeth, which was in the area of livestock to deduct the purchase price of livestock.
Madam Chair.
Representative Traeger.
I don't think that's a real good proposal.
You want one next year?
If you happen to be in the business of feeder cattle, and you buy them in the spring, and I don't know what the price is today at 65 or 66 cents a pound, and so you're selling them in the fall at 45 or 50, yeah, you've had some gain. But to deduct the full cost of those animals is, if we're going to do that, we ought to reduce the amount of income requirement and treat those that are growing row crops or whatever in the same way, because they have the same kinds of problems, and I think it's not a real realistic proposal.
I might respond to that, Representative Traherne, in that the language we had used in the original Ag for Oregon concept was that we deducted only the first 10 head of livestock, so that it really wasn't a factor for the real commercial operator. And you realize that, of course, when we talk about livestock, it's not just cattle, but it's sheep or anything else as well. But if we only deduct the first 10, I think we've mitigated the problem you speak of and gotten it down to where we're really only talking about that person who's trying to abuse the system.
We just got from Ms. Kanaki what she had handed out to LBD, and I think it's interesting on the 10,000 income. That They talk about their farm, and you'll see in the second paragraph that with corn, beans, wheat, strawberry, that per acre gross income averaged $788, which means that 12.7 acres provided $10,000 gross income, which means a dwelling could be on it. She further goes on to say that talking to the loan officer at the Albany branch of the Willamette Production Credit Association, asked them for conservative production averages and price figures on crops he's familiar with, and there's a chart relating to that. And I think that the last paragraph is important in that with this and with inflation, as farm prices go up, that the size parcel would be considerably smaller. Their original income test they wanted was $20,000, and they adjusted it to $10,000. Second page, it's got a test of what $10,000 would produce, and these are examples provided by a credit union. Strawberries, for example, would require only 3.13 acres for $10,000 gross. Sweet corn, 14.8 acres. Green beans, 17 acres. Wheat, 38 acres. Alfalfa, 25. You can read the rest on down. Table beans, 10. She further goes on to say that they provided conservative estimates of yields and tried to do it on the conservative side. And then at the bottom, Dave Lett, who has a vineyard, is average. What is this? I can't read an average price.
Three tons per acre makes them 10 acres. Average price per ton, let's see.
I can't read it.
Average plant acreage, you have 3 tons per acre, $1,000 a ton, so it's $20,000 an acre that they actually take in on.
On grapes they take in. On 10.7 acres produces $20,000 of income. Is that correct? That's what I have.
I think that's what I see here.
3 tons per acre, and I've got 10.7 acres with an arrow pointing to $20,000. So I'm assuming that they are grapes on his property, the average price that he can make. 20,000 gross on 10.7 acres of grapes.
The Washington County data, I might cite that if you're talking about grapes, they list 4.2 tons at $700 a ton, which gives them $2,940. It's per acre that the Washington County Extension Service data.
So that would be 5-something acres would qualify,
yes,
for
three
home if they were growing grapes on it.
I have additional data from Washington County. If I take the average of all their field crops, they end up with $261 an acre, and it goes from a low for grass hay of $82.50 an acre to a high of $616 for silage. So, but the average of all their field crops. But then I turn to their fruits and tree fruits and nuts, and the average is $632 per acre, giving them 15.8 acres would make $10,000. In the small fruits area, their strawberries apparently do better than what is reported on the one that Lois has given you, and they claim $5,332 per acre for their yield and price last year.
So,
depends on a lot of things, I'm sure. But anyway.
But I think the point is that there would be many farms if you were going to farm it. If your intent is to farm it, any farm it, that there would be many small acreages that would qualify, that are farmed, that would qualify for dwelling on it.
That's
the point that this is all about, representative training.
Hector, what's the philosophy behind allowing a home on different sizes of parcels of good farmland, depending on the crop that's grown? That's really what you're suggesting here. You're saying that if you grow strawberries, you can do it on three, but if you're growing alfalfa, you got to have 25. What's the reasoning with that kind of a philosophy?
Well, I'm sure that you recognize, Representative Traeger, and that there's a lot of variation in the amount of acres that a given farmer may farm to make an acceptable income that's either a part-time operation or a full-time operation. Obviously, in eastern Oregon, if you're in a cattle ranch, you've got to have a tremendously greater acreage. And the same thing applies here in the valley. We have a tremendous number of small parcels already out there that some people would like to farm. And I think of the person who may want to get started. They find a 10-acre parcel down the road, and they can make a down payment on that, and they can get started. But the only way now, under our test here, is that they've got to make the $10,000 out of that parcel. But the way they can do it is to put in a lot of sweat equity into this thing and to use their, they're going to pay for it. But they're going to show an awful lot of effort out there to make that small farm pay. We think that the small farms are a part of Oregon as much as large farms, and we want to have a place for them to do it. But we don't want to have a place out there where the person simply uses these farm parcels not as a part of the commercial part of the agriculture. If they're strictly non-farm, they ought to go into our rural residential or in within the urban growth boundary. So our philosophy is, yes, we want a place for people to use intensive type crops. The nearer you get to an urban area, the more opportunity there really is to not only use those parcels, but to probably sell directly to the public. And I can see a young person with not much equity or not much capital moving into one of those, let's say a 10-acre parcel or even perhaps smaller, and proving up on it for the first 2 years, maybe moves in a porta potty and just a shed out there for his tractor and farms it and then makes his $10,000 for 2 years, but he's got a home out there and he's got a farm operation that's worth something.
And your opinion?
Representative Traeger.
Looking at the example we have, Hector, and the example you were giving of this 10-acre parcel, why would you allow him to build a house on it if he raises table beets, but not build a house on it if he raises carrots? And they're about the same amount of effort.
I think we would. He would have to pick the thing that was appropriate for the size of his farm. Just like I have about 500 acres, and I need to pick something that's appropriate for my size of farm, and I wouldn't pick a cow-calf operation. I think he's got to pick something that's appropriate for the kind of land that he has. Obviously, if it's on above class 3, he probably can't do it. And he probably should know that, and he shouldn't try to do it.
No, we're talking about, let's say, some class 1 land that class will one grow either table beets or carrots.
He can,
Now, why do we tell him if he's raising beets, he can qualify, and if he's raising carrots, he can't?
We haven't. We've told him that he has to make $10,000, and if he chooses to grow one over the other, now I'm not so sure that he can't make it with either one, although I haven't dug out my
figures. I'm just going by the chart that we have, and assuming he's a typical farmer.
Typical farmer, right.
And, certainly there would be some variances. But if he grows one, 10 acres will qualify, and it takes 12 and a half if he's growing the other. Mm-hmm. It just doesn't seem reasonable to put that kind of a restriction on what crop you grow when,
he has a less economic unit if he can't bring in at least $10,000. Now, we farmers know that $10,000 gross is a terribly small amount of money. It's all right to augment your income with that, but you certainly couldn't live on it. So this is obviously a part-time operation, and then the part-time operation better look at something that'll bring in enough to give him some return and maybe prove up and let him have a home there.
I think you're missing my point.
I think I understand your point.
The health.
Those are, average yields.
Right.
Suppose the guy that you're talking about, Dick Benner,
1,000 frames for the record.
The person you're talking about has 10 acres, and he doesn't want to grow sugar beets, he wants to grow carrots. Let him grow carrots, and maybe he can beat the average yield, and he makes his $10,000, and he gets his house.
But if he can't, if it's average yield kind of land, well, he can't.
If he doesn't make 10,000, then he doesn't qualify, that's right.
Madam Chair, there's another little factor in here. Can he build that house even if it's down in the floodplain, where if he can grow carrots and beets successfully is where it probably is?
Hector McPherson, no, obviously that there are things that override this, and you have to abide by the other things that are in the ordinances that control building homes, and floodplain, of course, is one of those things that overrides where you can build a home, even though he may have produced the amount to have qualified by our test.
Sure. Representative Anderson.
I'd like to briefly run back to page 6, line 21, and ask
Representative Priestley had concerns, and I do too. There's a large difference between median and mean and average and all this type of thing. Why is it necessary to say it's not smaller than the average? Why can't we just say it is a farmer wood lot producing at least $2,500 in annual gross? What's the rationale? I guess I've asked Hector.
I'm not sure that I can. I'm not sure what the difference is. I'd have to think that through. Obviously, on average, we're not. If you're producing it, anyone. Lois, have you got that one thought through yet?
Lois Kanegi, Agriculture for Oregon. Going back, Madam Chair, Representative Anderson, on page 6, we're talking about lines 21 through 23. For one thing, the reason this criteria was chosen is because there is census data available to every county on that particular average farm or woodlot producing at least 2,500. That's why it would be inadvisable, in our opinion, to go to Representative Priestley's suggestion that we go median, because those facts would not be available. There is a given body of census data available on this. Your second question, if I understood correctly, was why not say that you can build if you are not smaller than the average, or you know, if you don't produce, or if you can produce 2,500 gross or more. I would like to remind you of Representative Van Leeuwen's comments that 10,000 in gross income is a very, very small amount. The chart that you were provided on the memo that I had done for LB Day is only illustrative. And as Representative Van Leeuwen commented, none of us farmers can survive on 10,000 gross income. 2,500 annual gross income is, in terms of commercial agriculture, hardly considered to be a farm or adequate. I think that you may want to talk to Scott Ashcombe about that. The reality is that the census data does list a lot of those people who have less than 2,500. Those of us in commercial agriculture have difficulty understanding how they could be called farms. The census data is available, but we think it would be far too inadequate a test if that were the only test, if that were used instead of the $10,000. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, I guess it does. I first was concerned about the booklet, and I guess beyond that, I was concerned about the difference between median and mean. Obviously, my definition of median makes it a lot more flexible than mean or average.
But the average figures are available, and are available twice in every decade. This is 78, and apparently the census will be taken again in 83, and it will be available again. So it would be available to every county every 5 years.
I guess I need to go to Representative Priestley, whether he's got that sort of
Well, I don't know what kind of a bill we're trying to build here. I'm in the way. I don't want to build a bill that these people don't want. But I don't want to, I don't like this one too.
How about one member of the department?
Right. So
a yes or a no?
Madam Chair, an unrelated question to the bill right now. Part of the committee is not here. Part of the rest of us would rather be on the floor. Are they on the floor, or what's, are they excused to be on the floor? While the rest of us are, frankly,
I don't know where they are. What an honest answer. I don't know where. They are not excused from the committee, and I would assume, therefore, they're not excused from the floor unless they're where they're supposed to be. The rest of us are excused from the floor.
Madam Chair, I think the point being, if someone is building up a voting record out there while we're sitting here slaving away on this bill, it's grossly unfair, because we're going to have piling up a lot of absent votes out there.
Yes, just like there are occasions when the Revenue Committee does that, and Judiciary Committee does that, and Ways and Means Committee does that, and this is one of four committees that we have had orders to stay open and continue our work and meet during floor sessions. So we can finish our work. Well, I have, if we would, if you would like to go back to floor session right now, we can certainly do that and reconvene at 5 and work through as late as we want to this evening. Not yet, that's the committee's wishes. Reconvene at 7. Whatever the committee would like to do. Would you like to leave and reconvene at 7?
Well, I wish all the committee were here, is what I'm saying.
I wish they were here too, and I don't know where they are.
Have a committee.
Do we have any more comments or any amendments to page 7?
Yes.
Beth reminds me we had that we might want to look at any two to just clarify this, and I think we asked Elizabeth to do it. If we want to add that any two consecutive years, calendar years, immediately prior within the 3 years prior to the application.
Two out of three.
Or two out of three consecutive years. Is there any problem with that?
Chairperson, I can't imagine raising an objection. Hector knows these things much better, but I'm just wondering, if you, when you go to a locking something into a calendar year, you don't have the flexibility of allowing just a 12-month period. What is wrong with that? No one's going to be hurt by just fixing any 12-month period, the two succeeding, or a 24-month period in a way. Isn't that, I hate to see someone denied on the basis that it was the wrong 12-month period. You have to be in a calendar. What is socially superior with the calendar? It doesn't mean with the season. I mean, so I'm in big trouble by that. Somebody can explain if that's a good idea?
Hector? Well, Hector McPherson, you realize that crops are harvested once a year. If you use a calendar year, you obviously are going to get all of that 1 year in. Now, there are crops that really you may plant 1 year and actually harvest the next. But on the average, a calendar year is what every farmer uses, but he may break it up. They have fiscal years. There are farmers that have fiscal years as well. But certainly, I see no objection to using the calendar year.
What's the benefit? It seems like why not just leave it any way? You can go January through December or September through May or September through July or August. I mean, why couldn't you just let that be elastic? Or there's a benefit you see in this, huh?
Madam Chair, we harvest timber year-round, and I guess it's obvious to me that you can go in and cut $10,000 worth of timber the last day before you apply it or something, or you can jockey it. So I don't know where that plugs in. I haven't even sorted that out.
Lois?
The fiscal years are being used right now primarily by corporate farms, and the corporate farms aren't going to be affected by this kind of small test. Any farmer who's working with a 10,000 gross income, I would make a pretty certain statement, would be using a calendar year in terms of their tax things. And I think calendar year simply is far simpler for the counties to administer, and I would encourage you to go with calendar year. I could also say that, for instance, we, because of the strange seasons, we harvested two harvests of strawberries in the last 12 months. I mean, from July. The bulk of our harvest of strawberries of 2 years happened between July 1, 1982 and July 1, 1983, just because of some flukes of weather. And so one could manipulate that, just like one can manipulate when you sell your wheat. But I think a calendar year is the simplest way to administer, and that's what we're looking for.
Representative
Van Leeuwen. I see one hole in what Mrs. Carnegie just said, though. If we're going on the fiscal year or the calendar year, if that person who was trying to establish the farm is a business person of some sort and may be operating their business on a different basis than the calendar year, I mean, they could do it that way too. That would be a
But it seems to me, yeah, I think you're right, but it seems to me you still have to deal with taxes, and your tax year stops.
I don't know that that's important or anything, but I think there was a hole in that particular thinking, because it's not always going to be that way. Many of the people who would be trying to establish one of these farm dwellings would be people who are business people or have jobs elsewhere away from the farm, as I see it.
Representative Anderson.
Why do we allow for the mint grower who keeps his oil for 3 years and that's being done currently. The mint market is down, and he has no.
That, Hector McPherson, that is a possibility, and there are a few crops that tend to be held from one year to another. It is not the usual thing. Most farmers have to settle up with their banker once a year, and so they have to sell their crops. I do know a few cases where seed crops have been held more than one year, but then, by and large, by making it consecutive years, you might throw the income higher in one year and lower in the next, but by and large, I think you're going to iron out the problems that you could get into otherwise, unless you do make it two consecutive years and give them some option. The calendar year is only a convenient thing, is a tool, as I see, to give some certainty and to set it up in the state law. I don't see that there would make any great problem for anybody to use the calendar year, even though they might happen to be on a fiscal year.
Is there any objection? So,
Madam Chairperson?
Representative Priestley.
The question of the mint oil, though, is one in which you have, which language, are we talking about top of page 7?
Well, that whole thing needs to be rewritten.
Well, it'd be rewritten in such a way that a person produces, say, $10,000 worth of mint oil, but he still has it. He doesn't have to, in other words,